Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Views on View. I'm your host, Lindsay Wardell. With me today is Raymond Camden.
Hello.
Welcome. And our special guest today is Michael, I'm blanking on your last name, Thiessen. Is that correctly?
Thiessen.
I apologize about that. Welcome, Michael.
No problem. Glad to be here.
Yeah.
Leveling up is important. I spend at least an hour every day learning ways I can improve my business or take a break and listen to a good book. If you're looking to level up, I recommend you start out with the 12-week year as a system to plan out where you want to end up and how to get the results you want. You can get it free by going to audibletrial.com/code. That's audibletrial.com/code.
Michael is a returning guest. You may have heard him on our episode 121 talking about reusable components. And in that episode, we were talking about the 6 layers of reusability that you were developing and putting a course together about. And this time, your course is ready to be released. Is that correct?
Yeah. So November 3rd, this course is launched. And so, yeah, excited about that for sure.
Yeah. And as part of preparing for this episode, you gave me the opportunity to preview the course, which I have been thoroughly enjoying, getting a lot of good information out of. And so, yeah, we just wanted to talk to you about the course and kind of what it covers, how it can help developers. And I'd also like to talk about your process and how you got the course built and set up and deployed for everyone to use. How does that sound?
Sounds great.
Cool. So before we dive into it, let's just recap the 6 levels of reusability for our listeners. And anyone who wants a longer version of this, please go and listen to our episode 121. If you'd like an even longer version, I highly recommend the course. It is an excellent place to learn all about building reusable components.
Yeah. So
Michael, go ahead.
The 6 levels are, number 1 would be templating. And then there is configuration, then adaptability, inversion, extension, and then nesting. So each of these levels, I like to think of them as not like fundamental laws of the universe. These are just like some concepts I came up with. So I like to say that you should feel free to disagree with me because I can be wrong and you can maybe add some things here or there. But yeah, so these 6 different levels in more detail. So templating is like the most basic thing you think of when you think of components. So it's just reusing a chunk of code by wrapping it up inside of a component. So instead of copying and pasting, you can use a component to sort of provide as a template. The 2nd level is configuration. So now we're starting to use props to alter the behavior of a component in various different ways. So you can have a component that has a compact view or maybe a more descriptive view. And so you can control the behavior a little bit. And so you get a little bit more variation within a single component. The 3rd level is adaptability. So we move on from using props to now starting to use slots a little bit. And the reason that we like to use slots is that props have some inherent limitations with them where you can't give someone a blank check in essence with a prop as much as you can with a slot. A slot gives you much more of like this blank space that you can then fill in later on. And so it gives you an ability to future-proof your components and make them adaptable. The 4th level is inversion, and that's where we dig into scoped slots. And the reason it's called inversion is that we're using inversion of control, where we have a child component that will give up control over what's being rendered to the parent component through the use of a scoped slot. And so that gives you quite a bit more flexibility in terms of how your component is being written. Then with level 5, we start to take these concepts that we've built on and sort of push it to the max within a single component and start adding in extension points in different places in the component. So this lets us override various aspects of a component however we see fit. So you could have a footer of a modal for example. And with extension, you could override that footer to be something else. And then the last one would be nesting, where we now move outside of a single component and see how we can apply slots to an entire component hierarchy. And by passing extension points around in that component hierarchy, we can do some really interesting things that are quite a bit of fun to think about.
Awesome. Are you going to say something, Raymond?
Yeah. So I was going to say, you know, I still feel like a beginner Vue person. I've been doing it for a couple of years. My component usage is probably, what level was prompts? Level two, level three?
Yeah, level two.
Yeah. So I've done slots. So I've done scope slots. When do you feel like how long were you working with Vue where you felt like, you know, I'm hitting these kind of like mental walls. I need to think more about how I do my components. You know, like roughly how long were you along your journey of learning Vue?
Yeah. So I kind of think about it more of the requirements for your application. Mm-hmm. So it's like for my website is written in Vue, but it's a pretty simple blog. And so I don't really do that much with it. I'm maybe on like level two or level three in terms of the components that I'm writing. Mm-hmm. But at my day job, it's a much larger application that's much longer lived and being worked on every day. And so that's how I ended up developing up to this level six, because I've been heavily involved in building component libraries and also just building components that can be used across an entire app, across dozens of developers all working on the same thing.
So it's funny you mentioned component libraries, because I definitely see things in Vue that I think it's good that it's in there, but I'll never use it. But I can see people who are building like Vue Bootstrap, like they need it. Is there a feeling in terms of how much of those six levels would apply to people building libraries versus people who are using libraries?
Yeah. So I think if you're building a library, you're probably going to, there's a bigger focus on reusability for sure. I mean, that's kind of like the entire point of a component library. And at the same time, though, it's in a larger application that you're still going to see the value of reusability, but it might be less frequent, because more often you're going to build a one-off thing here and there, or something that might be used, you know, across a couple different pages or a couple different modals. So you don't need to have as much reusability. But then you do get into things like if you're building an application and you have a header that sort of acts like a toolbar or something like that. And if that's present on every single page across your application, but takes on slightly different forms and is used slightly differently, then that kind of a component is definitely where something like nesting comes into play, where you have this thing across maybe 50, 60 different pages used and being used in all these different ways.
Yeah. Since we spoke last, I've been itching to do some refactoring on the project I do at work. We have a component that is used on just about every page. And it is ripe for using scoped slots and applying some of the concepts that you have for extension and nesting. On the other hand, it's a component that is heavily used in the application. And there's so much at this point, there's so much technical debt in how it functions today that it makes it hard to refactor. So one thing I did while I was going through the course is I started working on a new data table for our application. So we've got three or four different ones that all use different variants of props. And I tried to apply some of the concepts of extension there. And I've really enjoyed the way that you talk about these things and how you demo them in your course, because I'm able to very easily apply what you're doing to what I need to do and get those things into my code base. And that just started, you know, while I was preparing for this episode today. So we haven't been able to roll that out into production yet, but I can clearly see the benefits. And I showed it to another team member and I explained, I've been demoing this course. Look at these things. He's like, oh my goodness, this is great. So he's all on board with this concept now.
Great. That's great to hear.
While you were putting together the course, I'm curious if there were any of the sections the levels of reusability that you found, like you felt were the most important to try and get across to the listener, to your student, as it were?
Yeah. So this is definitely something that I thought a lot about how to structure things and what was important to include and what was not important to include. I actually spent a lot of time just editing things out that might be like sort of interesting, but not worth the time. And it's interesting because I think the earlier levels are much more common, and like you're using components, you're using props, maybe you're using slots here and there. And so those patterns are used a lot more. And so it's really important to talk about those because it's, you know, the bread and butter, the core of what we're pretty much doing all the time. But at the same time, these higher levels have a lot more impact or leverage. And so if you use extension one time, that can be a huge deal. And so, you know, there's kind of a trade-off there. And so, yeah, so it's not really a great answer to your question, but that's the way I think about it, at least.
That's fine. And that makes sense to me, comparing with my team, where obviously everyone very much uses props, very much understands slots. Named slots is understandable. But then when we get into scope slots, that's definitely a part that's a little more tricky to understand if you're coming at it from a different perspective. We have one developer that's been, you know, he's worked in a number of different frameworks, not single page applications necessarily, just back in server-side rendered frameworks. And when he looked at slots, he was a little bit confused just because it didn't follow the web standard. It was a view concept. So I can definitely understand needing to put more emphasis on the scoped slots and the concepts behind that.
Yeah, and with slots and scope slots, I have lessons for each of those in turn, especially the scope slots. I've found that it's tricky to understand and wrap your head around. And so, yeah, it was important to make sure that people understand how they work, and not just how to use them, but not just how to consume them if you're using a third-party library that has them, but understanding them enough that you can actually use them yourself in your own components.
Yeah, I agree there. And I see in your module about inversion, there's a whole section about scope slots. I like the title there, Why Are Scope Slots Upside Down?
Yeah.
I don't remember when it finally clicked for me, but I think we actually had a conversation briefly on Twitter, Michael, where I tweeted, I was like, wait, so scope slots is this, right? And you were like, yeah, basically. I definitely appreciated that light bulb moment, and it definitely opened some new opportunities for writing code that isn't just library code, because I always thought it was just a library code type thing, but it actually helps an application too.
Yeah, and it's those aha moments that I think are the most valuable. They're the things that I've found the most valuable as I've gotten more experienced with frameworks. Like once you're familiar with Vue and you've used it for 6 months or a year or whatever, and you're not like, you know, diving into the docs every 5 minutes to try and figure out how to do stuff. Like once you've gone past that stage, it's those like changes in how you think about things, or like almost like paradigm shifts in your head. All of a sudden you can view these things from a different angle, and suddenly you can understand more about what you're doing. And so that was one major goal for me with this course, was not so much teaching about features or how to use slots or how to use scoped slots even, but trying to give you as many of those aha moments as possible, so that, you know, you walk away from this course having like a wider set of tools for thinking about things that you maybe wouldn't have gotten otherwise.
So having not done the course yet myself, that sounds amazing. You know, again, I still feel like a beginner. And one of the things that I've struggled with in many programming languages is that there's typically great intros, great advanced material, but not a lot of things that help you become better than beginner. Like, you're not looking to become a Jedi, you're just looking to become more competent. And it absolutely sounds like everything you're talking about would be perfect for people who have gotten past the Hello World and Vue. And, you know, and Vue itself is so easy, but I think getting past the easy stuff, people would need help. And again, this sounds perfect.
Yeah, that was definitely what I was going for. This course is definitely aimed at like intermediate and advanced. It assumes that you already have a pretty good grasp of Vue and you're able to be productive with it already. Mm-hmm. But it's there to help you get even better with it.
So I'd like to talk about some of the tools that were used in putting together the course. And part of that includes the hosting and release of it. But the first one I noticed while I was watching is that you're using the composition API from Vue 3.
Yeah.
As your code examples. I thought that was really cool. I'd love to hear how you felt making that transition from the options API to the composition API in particular, needing to have it down enough to write the material for this course.
Yeah, so I've played around with the composition API a little bit here and there, but I've never actually, before this course, used it for anything substantial. And so I wanted to make sure that this course was not going to be out of date before it even launched. And so getting onto Vue 3 and even just using the composition API was something that I felt was important. Even though you can still use the options API with Vue 3. But yeah, it was actually it wasn't too difficult to figure out, I think. For me, the best part was that the part that made it easier for me was that the logic in the examples for the course are not actually like that involved or that crazy. And so making that switch was relatively straightforward. And I had been doing experiments with the composition API and playing around with it enough to have like enough of a basic grasp on it. And so, yeah, the Vue team has done an extremely good job with the composition API, in my opinion.
And that's great to hear because I am still working on a Vue 2 application. And because we're targeting Internet Explorer, we're not yet able to upgrade. But it's really good to hear that you had such a good experience. I mean, granted, the code examples are just that. That's not the full logic for some complex things. But the fact that you were able to make that migration yourself, that sounds great. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. If you haven't used the composition API yet, it's not a huge task to figure it out if you're already familiar with computed props and watchers and all the rest. And also they made it fully optional, which is even better because you don't have to. You can take your time and you know, incrementally update too.
Right. Another thing I noticed, and I'm somebody who pays attention to the details in videos, is I noticed you were using Tailwind, it looks like, for your styling. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yes, I am.
And this is more off topic from Vue, but how do you feel about Tailwind? Obviously, you're using it and you like it, I would assume, but I'd just like to get your opinion on that.
I would say that I'm fully behind Tailwind. I've been using it for, I don't know, a year and a half now, I think, on my blog and then also in this course. And I haven't had any issues with it. And it's really easy to use and to just, you know, get something out there. And tweaking things is so easy. Even refactoring things, I think that's the big sticking point people have with it is what happens when you go to refactor. But I've found it to be very useful. I don't think I'm using it like, I don't think I'm using 100% of what it's capable of, but I definitely want to figure out more of it.
Cool.
Heard of Tailwind, but you know, outside of hearing about it, what is in that would be something that I would be interested in? Is it like Bootstrap? Is it less than Bootstrap or different than Bootstrap?
Yeah, so it's a CSS utility framework. So it's just CSS classes, essentially. Yeah. And so instead of coupling your HTML with your CSS, you have it fully decoupled. And so everything that you want to do is a style. And so if you, or it's a class. And so if you want to do layout with Flexbox, then it's just a series of classes that you put onto those HTML elements. And then you get your Flexbox layout. And then there's different prefixes and things like that. So you could do responsive layouts and things like that. And so it's actually pretty powerful. Yeah, like if you want the text size to change at different breakpoints, you can do MD for like a medium screen, colon, class name. And then you have your responsive media query baked into that class. And then away you go.
Yeah, I am a huge Tailwind proponent. So I love seeing it when it appears in courses or pictures or something. So awesome.
When I first started taking computer science classes in college, I thought programming was just a joke. In fact, I changed my major over to engineering and started doing computer engineering and chip design. Then I found Ruby and I fell in love. I love Ruby. It was my first real programming language where I dove deep and really learned how to make software that makes a difference for other people. Since then, and the way that we got started with devchat.tv, we started a show called Ruby Rogues. It's currently in the 400s of episodes. We've talked to hundreds of people in the Ruby community about the Ruby community, about the Ruby programming language, about Rails, and about what makes good programming. So if you're interested in Ruby Rogues, or you just want to hear a long series of experienced programmers talking about real problems, then go check out rubyrogues.com.
I'd like to talk about some of the other tools that you used, and this is more on the hosting and release of the course. And maybe we can also talk about some of the things you used to actually record everything. But I noticed as I was going through that you were using Netlify for your hosting. Mm-hmm. I believe you were using Auth0. Hope I can say that. Using Auth0 for your authentication. And I think it was Vimeo for the video hosting. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So what led you to choose those options for the hosting of this new course?
So Netlify was a pretty easy choice. I've used Netlify for years now with my blog and with my last course, Clean Components. And I have all of my checkout and authentication logic and everything like that in Netlify functions. And it's so easy to configure and to just have things work. And especially for the kinds of things that I'm doing where they're not very backend heavy at all. And so these quick little Lambda functions are just like the perfect thing for that. And so, yeah, the infrastructure side of things is I basically copied what I had done for my previous course and then, you know, updated some things here and there. The video hosting is done with Vimeo. And the main reason I went with Vimeo is because they offer 4K at 60 frames per second. And I know that not everyone, maybe not even the majority of people, will be watching these videos at that high of a bit rate. But I don't know, just for my own personal satisfaction, I wanted to be able to provide that, because I don't know, when I'm watching YouTube and or anything else really, I enjoy the higher quality videos, and you know, I try and get the highest resolution I can. So why not do that with my course?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I appreciate that I can be playing the video on either a small screen or a large screen, and the quality still comes through. So I'm able to read the code. Like you were saying, on YouTube, sometimes you'll find videos where for some reason they weren't able to save it in a higher resolution, and the code itself is kind of blurry and harder to read. But yeah, these videos come through nice and clear. And I think you were using Auth0, correct, for the authentication?
Yep.
How is that integration going? I tried using Auth0 a bit for a side project, and I wasn't quite successful fast enough, and I realized this was just a prototype, so I set it aside and moved on. How have you felt about using it?
Well, I've had some issues with it, but I don't know if it's Auth0 or if it's just my lack of understanding. I mean, maybe it's both combined. But I mean, authentication is in my experience dealing with it, it's always complicated. And it's complicated to have something that's actually properly secure. I could you know, throw up something that looks like it's secured, but, you know, having something that's done properly is beyond my abilities, I would say. And so I like knowing that there's someone else dealing with all those complexities. And granted, it's an online course. And so, like, I mean, it's not like I'm doing anything confidential or like top secret, but, you know, it's still something that's important to do.
Can you talk about, so I assume you're using Vue for the course layout as well, but is there, like, how are you using Vue and how did that impact the secure aspect, if at all?
Yeah, so I'm not sure that it actually affects it that much. It's just you have to have some hooks into your application so that you can log in and and do redirects and whatnot as appropriate.
So is the front-end courseware, is it using a particular Vue framework? Is it using Next or whatever?
Yeah, so for the website that hosts the course, I'm using VuePress. Yeah, so my blog is in Gridsome, and for my courses, I decided to, you know, branch out a little bit and get some experience with some other frameworks, and so that's why it's in VuePress. Cool.
This may be greedy. I mean, you've just done the course, but then I would love to see a presentation / blog post on how you built the course. Yeah, essentially what we're talking about today, but I would love to see a long form version of you talking about this in detail. I think that'd be great.
Yeah. Maybe I'll do that someday then.
You're almost done. Right? You're almost done. We all have plenty of time.
On the note of VuePress though, what's your experience been with that? The most I have used VuePress is when I was experimenting with VitePress just to prove that it worked. But yeah, my main website is written in Gridsome, and most of my other projects either use the Vue CLI or Nuxt. So I'd be curious about your experience there.
Yeah. So VuePress, the approach there is that it's more based on configuration. And so it errs on the side of being quick and easy to set up, but maybe a little limiting in how it's used. So something like Gridsome, I found a lot easier to get whatever I want in there. Press, I found, requires a little bit more hacking around what it wants to do. But also, I'm not necessarily using VuePress in the way that it's meant to be used, which is for documentation. And so generally with documentation, like, you just want to write some markdown and get something up. And that's the whole point. And so for its aim, I think it's a really good tool. But like using VuePress for your personal blog is, you're trying to like shoehorn this thing into a completely different use case, basically. That's at least my impression of it. I could be totally wrong.
Hey, that was my impression as well. You have more experience with it, so I was curious. While we're talking about Gridsome, and again, this is slightly off topic from the course, I've been very intrigued with what's going on with Nuxt, especially Nuxt content. And I've been considering redoing my blog from Gridsome to Nuxt just to get that experience. Have you had similar thoughts? Have you been following what's going on in Nuxt?
I've been following a little bit. I don't think I've ever used Nuxt, like not even in like a small project that I abandoned 10 minutes later, which is probably like, it's something I want to look into more because they're doing some really interesting things. My hope is that in the long run, the company I work at, we could switch to having some things done with Nuxt, but that's like, you know, a years long thing. So, but you know, I've got that in the back of my head, and yeah, hopefully we'll get there someday.
Yeah, I'm in a similar boat where at this point I have two Nuxt applications that I'm maintaining at work, but that's two of maybe three Nuxt applications total in the company, and most of it is not using Node at all. So it's definitely on my list of things to help the company with as well. Yeah. So what was it like for you just making the course itself? What was it like going through the process of coming up with the modules and putting together all of this content? And then if you like, maybe we can also talk about just the process of editing and going through all of the the videos? I would imagine you have to watch them a few times just to make sure everything is correct.
Yeah. So I think the biggest thing that I didn't realize upfront was it's a psychologically difficult thing to do. And I say that because it's like, I've spent at this, I think it would be a total of about 5 months working on this course, like part-time. And the first like almost 2 months was just figuring out how to do video, how to like, what lights should I get? How do I set them up? How do I do that? How do I record and then get it into editing? How do I edit it? Like sort of figuring out that process just to get like a decent quality video done. And then the rest of the process was figuring out the content and then actually creating the content and recording and editing. So it's a fairly big undertaking. I don't think I've ever done anything like this, like in this scope before, like 5 months beginning to end, not knowing if it will turn out well or not, and just hoping that I can finish it and come out the end relatively unscathed and that others will actually appreciate it too. And so there's definitely a lot of times where I just completely doubted myself and my abilities and like, you know, hit that pit of despair where I'm just like, why am I even doing this? Like, what is this point? Like the lowest of lows. And then luckily I found that those moments passed and then I could get back to, you know, actually working on the thing. And so, yeah, that was the biggest thing for me. And so I think if I wanted to like communicate to anyone else who's interested in doing a course or writing an ebook or, you know, anything like that, it's like, it's possible, but know that there are times that you will feel completely down, but you know, you just got to push through it basically and maybe start small, start with small projects and work your way up.
Nice. Thank you. On the note of the video itself, you were commenting on having to choose how to even record. What did you end up using for recording the video?
Yeah, so I have a Sony Alpha camera, and so I've been using that to record. And so I record my video and then simultaneously have a screen recording going. And then I'm using Final Cut Pro to edit things. And so for some reason, there's like the timing of the two devices is slightly off. So like after 10 minutes, the 10 minute long video, even if you line them up at the beginning, then after 10 minutes, there's a bit of drift. And so like the one video will be like a few seconds shorter than the other. So at first I was just like trying to like chop up the video to realign it. And then I figured out that Final Cut Pro has this magic synchronize clips button and it just lines everything up nicely. So I do that, line everything up, and then combine the two video sources that way.
Nice. And I forgot to check this while I was looking at the course. Are you doing subtitles as well?
Yes. So I have captions on all of the videos.
How'd you do that?
You asked my question. Go ahead.
Yeah. So it was actually a lot easier than I was expecting, which was great. So there's a service called Rev, and it integrates with Vimeo as well as Vidyard. So I didn't talk about this before, but the company I work for is also a video hosting company. Although the target audience is more, the use case is more targeted towards sales and marketing. And so, you know, I have to plug it a little bit at least. And so what Rev does is it actually links back to your video account. And I think they do this with many other video providers and whatever. And so I logged into this thing on Rev and I granted access to my video account. And then I just selected all the videos and hit caption and then put in my credit card details. And then like 10 hours later, they were all captioned and captions uploaded to the videos. And that was it.
Are you comfortable giving a ballpark in terms of captioning? Like, let's say I want to make a video, like a 4-hour long video, and it's me talking for roughly 4 hours. Do you feel okay, like ballparking what I should figure I'll have to pay for that?
Yeah. So Rev does $1.25 a minute, I think it is. And then, yeah. So from that, it's pretty easy to calculate whatever the length of videos are.
Using my calculator now.
that's in US dollars, correct?
Yeah, that's US.
Or is that? Okay.
So 4 hours would be $300, which is not bad at all to add that support to help others use the videos. That seems pretty good.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, people who have different abilities and hearing, but also there's the web development community. And I think especially with the Vue community, I've noticed is that it's very, very international, and it's easy sometimes to forget that not the whole, like the whole world doesn't just magically know English, as and lots of people, the majority of people are not native English speakers. And so that was important for me too. And so it's pretty cheap to add that in. I was expecting a much longer, arduous ordeal to get everything done, but it was very nice.
It's awesome. Thank you. We're getting close to time. Are there any other points that you would like to touch on as far as either your process or the content in the course? Is there anything we missed?
Yeah. So one thing I wanted to mention about the course was that it arcs from the beginning to the end. And so I spent a lot of time trying to make it a holistic experience. That maybe sounds weird, but what I mean by that is that it actually builds each lesson, each module builds on itself as we go through the course. And so I don't know how far you've gone with the course, but we start with building some modals. And then as we go through the course, we expand on that and see how we can make those modals more and more reusable and how that leads into different patterns and these different levels of reusability.
Yeah. And I started at the beginning and I've been going through. I've noticed that it just builds on top of itself. I really appreciate that, instead of just giving you a blank set of here's some brand new code. You have no context for it. You understand where it came from because you went through from the beginning to that point.
Yeah. It also made it a bit easier for me to put together because I didn't have to keep coming up with new examples for every lesson. So
sure,
that's not the reason I did it, but it certainly helps.
Thanks. Awesome. Raymond, do you have any other questions? I have one more. I just want to check in with you first.
No, I'm very excited to check it out. Again, I feel like I'm a probably prototypical person for this course, where I'm a very experienced beginner and very much looking to get above that.
All right. So my final question would be, let's say somebody comes to you and they ask, Michael, what tips do you have on building a new course? I know you talked about getting through the lows and some of the tools that you've used. Do you have any final tips that you would give to someone who's wanting to build a similar project on, you know, either Vue or another language or framework?
I would say that if you're wanting to get started and you haven't really done any sort of content creation of any kind, or even if you've just written like a couple of blog posts here or there, I would say the most important thing would be to start small. And if that's even just taking some ideas that you have for a course and writing about them in blog posts, or recording a couple of videos and putting them out there, that first video takes a really long time to figure out how to do. And even just getting over like that fear of being in front of a camera and feeling awkward, and eventually you realize you can edit things out and you don't have to worry so much. But like that whole process, I think you don't want to throw yourself into the deep end too quickly. That's what I would suggest. If you're just starting out, just take those small steps and sort of get used to the idea of putting content out there and putting yourself out there. And it's also a good way of testing to see what people might like and what types of content people enjoy. Yeah, I think it's a lot harder to just go from zero to putting together an entire video course. And I'm sure that there are a lot of people who have tried to do that, but didn't make it all the way because it's just like biting off way too much at once. And so that would be my advice.
Awesome. Thank you. Really appreciate that. And thank you for coming back to talk about the course now that it's ready to come out. As we are recording this episode, it's a couple weeks before, but you should be hearing this around the time that the podcast or the course is fully available. So definitely recommend you go and check it out if you're interested in what we've been talking about. And Michael, where can people find the course so we can make sure they're able to get to it?
Yeah, so you can find it at michaelntison.com/reusable-components. I'm sure that link will be in the show notes somewhere. You can also Google Michael Thiessen or probably just Michael and Vue, and you'll end up on my site and you'll be able to find it from there.
Awesome. Thank you. All right.
Hey, folks, this is Charles Maxwood, and I just launched my book, The Max Coder's Guide to Finding Your Dream Developer Job. It's up on Amazon. We self-published it. I would love your support. If you want to go check it out, you can find it there, The Max Coder's Guide to Finding Your Dream Developer Job. Have a good one. Max out.
And at this point, we will move on to picks. For those who are not aware, picks are the part of the show where we share things that we like with you. It doesn't have to be programming related. Sometimes it is. So I will let Michael take a break. And Raymond, do you have a pick for us today?
I do. Unfortunately, I could share a link, but it's a Goodreads link. It's a book that's, I think, out of print, maybe hard to find, but it's a biography on Mata Hari, who I knew the name because it's an interesting name. And I knew she was a spy and all that and a interesting woman. But the book is really kind of cool, and I'm learning a lot more about her. And unfortunately, I've read like one book the entire year, so it's taking forever to finish, but that's my fault, not the book's. And I'm putting a link in right now, and good luck finding it, but it's worth the effort, I think.
What was the title again?
The official title is Mata Hari, a biography by Sam, I'm probably going to say this wrong, Wagenaar, with lots of A's.
Oh my. Yes. That is a lot of A's. For those who are not reading our notes yet, there are four A's in that name that he was pronouncing. Awesome. Thank you. So my pick today is a website that I also don't know how to pronounce exactly. I'm going to say it is uxl.com or uxl, but I don't think that's right. You spell it uxcel.com. And the goal behind it, I feel, is to be the Duolingo of UX design. You're able to sign up for a free account and you walk through. It feels very much like Duolingo, where they present you some options, either pictures or text, and you choose what you think best matches the question. And I've just done the beginning so far, and they were talking a bit about color theory. They were talking about the difference between different types of UX, talking about primary colors, secondary colors, things like that. And there's these nice descriptions that, you know, about a paragraph's worth of text for each answer that you, or each question that you go through. And so step by step, you're learning more and more about how to design with UX UI concepts. And I have been enjoying it. I don't know if they have an app, but their website is a progressive web app. So you can install it on your phone. So that is my recommendation today.
That looks really cool. Michael, I'll have to check it out.
Yeah. I've been having a lot of fun with that. Michael, do you have a pick for us today?
Yeah. So I don't know if this might be breaking the rules of what's a valid pick or not, but lately me and my wife have been having tea time in the afternoon, which has been pretty fun. We, you know, it's just nice to have a little break. You know, around 3 o'clock, I usually start to, my brain starts to shut off for a little bit. So it's nice to have a bit of a pick me up, I guess. Have some tea, have some biscuits. Yeah.
That sounds very nice.
It sounds a lot more sophisticated than it actually is.
That's fair. What tea do you like to drink?
I drink a lot of black tea. I like anything that's pretty strong. My favorite kind of tea would be Assam, but I'm usually too lazy and just get like the Tetley, like orange pekoe in a bag thing. So sometimes I do loose leaf tea, but not all the time.
Yeah, I really got started with tea while I was in Brazil, and I got some, I think it was a regular ginger tea, but they actually use ginger in it instead of the bag. So that's when I got started with tea. definitely a fan. Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us again, Michael. For those who would like to reach out to you and talk to you more about this, where can they find you on the internet?
So I'm on Twitter at Michael Thiessen. You can reach me there. You can tweet at me. I'm also on my blog, and you can reach me there or browse the archives and see what I've written there.
Thank you. I will note Michael's blog is excellent. I did a Google search looking for how to nest scope slots, and it came up with his article on a component about building a V4 component.
Yeah.
Which was fun. It was fun to read. Yeah. Great. So I will make sure the links are there to both Twitter and your blog. And if you enjoyed this episode, hope you reach out to us as well. You can find us at viewsonview.com or at devchat.tv. You can also find us on Twitter at viewsonview. You can talk to me on Twitter at Yagabush, and you could speak with Raymond at Raymond Camden.
Nice and simple.
Hope you enjoyed this episode, and we'll see you again next week.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.